This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 30, Episode 6. Coming up on the show, we've got Crisis Electrocutions, The Resurrection Men, and the Screeching Dwarf Nurgles of Devil's Forest. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Oh, I thought I had a killer intro with the, Crisis Electrocutions. I didn't realize we have, what are they called? The Nurgle?
You don't have Dwarf Nurgles of the Evil Forest, my friend.
What's a Nurgle? I'm assuming it's a diminutive little freaky creature.
Yeah, I went into this new book, and I mentioned this on the last show that I was going to take a look at this. It's from Nathaniel Brislin. It's called Crawlers, a Conclusive Casebook. And this goes back to the Dover Demon case from the 1970s that Lorraine Coleman coined.
Wasn't the Dover Demon like a 3 foot tall, kind of skinny, weird, I don't know, was it an oval headed kind of diminutive creature?
Yeah, really pale skin, glowing orange eyes, 3 to 4 feet tall. And it was seen in the late 1970s, I think it was 1977, by four independent witnesses who didn't know each other, and they all saw this thing and each described it in the same way, all within this 24-hour period in Dover, Massachusetts, back in 1977.
What a hotbed that particular period of time was in that part of the world. In fact, I was only just looking at a documentary earlier this week. It's been out for a little while now, but it's the Bridgewater Triangle.
Yeah, I was looking at that today too.
Yeah, right. And of course, Lauren Coleman, features in that quite a lot. And many of the cases he refers to happened in the 1970s. And of course, with Stan Gordon, he did a lot of research into activity, in that kind of section of the world, of there being, like the Mothman and that kind of stuff as well. So it seems like the 1970s were just really intense with all that kind of stuff. But
yeah,
he reminded me of a story. There was a guy in there that described one of these little creatures, right? And I think it went back to American Indian folklore. I think they were called, is it called the pug?
The pockawee or something.
Something like that.
I can't remember.
These are 3 to 4 foot tall creatures. And, people go, oh, it's just part of, oral traditions or folklore. But the funny thing was, is that there was a guy that claimed that he encountered one of these things. It was 3 to 4 feet tall. It was a yubnub. It was covered in hair. And it was calling to him. It was trying to speak English to him.
What?
And he claimed that it was making this howling, wailing kind of noise, but it was trying to say something like, come with us or come with me. And of course, he got the hell out of there.
So this new book from Brislin is essentially a collection of cases that are very similar to that. And I link it back to the Dover Demon because they're all the same kind of thing, but he calls them crawlers. This is the new term that was coined. And It's similar to creepypasta. You can go back to that image of the so-called rake entity, which was that creepypasta.
It's, sitting down like it's about to spring forth. It was glowing white.
Like a trail cam photo in the forest, which was obviously, it's a fake photo, but this spurred on this whole, urban legend of these entities.
Why is it fake, Ben? No. Why is it fake? How is it any more fake than UFOs abducting a jetliner? Hey?
I didn't say it was fake. I just said that photo was fake. Not the entire phenomenon. And actually, I'm glad you raised that because that brings me to this collection of cases. And I think many of them are worth examining, especially in context of the Dover Demon case. Because remember, as I said, four independent eyewitnesses, their sketches matched, their descriptions were identical. And you might look at that little hotspot in the 1970s and think, well, this activity kind of came and went. But according to the compilation from Brislin, it didn't. People have been seeing things up into the modern era. And there's always going to be that question of, okay, is this a creepypasta story? Because a lot of them are anonymous and, very dubious tales. But there's
a
lot of
tell with some of them.
There's a lot of similarities. Yeah. And I've got one case of an Aussie guy seeing one of these freaky little Nurgle things in the forest.
Just even the word, I don't know, it feels wrong. Nurgle things.
Well, Nurgle's from, it's probably a really old term, but I remember it from the Warhammer games. It's like the Nurgle was from the Chaos Armini. It was one of those big, bloated, like disgusting zombie freaks with like gore coming out of it. That was a Nurgle. You never seen Nurgle?
No,
before?
I haven't. No.
Okay. Look it up. We'll put it in the show notes.
We'll look it up.
We'll put a Nurgle in the show
notes. Right. Yep. We'll get into that.
What have you got coming
up? Well, I wanted to go into actually this really fantastic book that I picked up. So I was recently covering doppelgangers, right? I was covering that story of doppelgangers and people encountering their doubles. And there was this great book that was written by Rodney Davies. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, he writes so well that I wanted to see if he's done any other works. And he actually has. He's published this book called Buried Alive, Horrors of the Undead. And looking at the reviews, it was like, don't read this. It's disgusting and revolting and awful. So I'm like, oh, I need to read it. Like, I definitely need to do it. And there is. There's a lot of that stuff that comes up in this particular book. Like, I won't shy away from the fact that it's there are, you know, a lot of dreadful elements that happen. But this is life, right? This is actually what happens. This is what has happened throughout history. Death is a topic that we shy away from. Mm. And with death, you know, we often get it wrong. And we certainly have gotten it wrong in the past. And in fact, the phrase that came to my mind, funnily enough, even today, is that death is not an exact science. It really isn't. And this book highlights that.
What do you mean death is an exact science? Well, isn't it a very exact science?
No.
If you're alive, then you're dead?
No, that's actually, it seems to be very much a very gray area as to when you're actually dead. So these days, obviously, it's, you know, clinical death occurs once you've had brain death occur. Mm. But the reality of it is that there has been multiple, like many, many reports throughout history of people that have seemingly died, suffered from brain death, been submerged for hours on end, for example, and yet resurface and come back to life. Now, does this have some type
of... Talking about people that it gets swamped in a avalanche, then they get half frozen and then
revived kind of
later on.
Yeah, that kind
but
of
they were
stuff.
Never actually dead.
Well, these particular stories, they actually are, right? And okay. So I've got some stories, I mean, especially in the past, like when I say it's not an exact science, it definitely wasn't in the 1500s, 1600s, you know, into...
Yeah,
like we got...
He stopped breathing, quick, put him under.
Yeah, we got it really, really wrong back then. But even more recently in the 1990s, we still get it wrong. Like this book goes up to cases in the 1990s, obviously because when it was published, but there are numerous examples of people falling into diabetic comas, being declared dead, only to, you know, come to on a slab in a morgue, and just due to, you know, fortunate circumstances, they're saved from the horrors of death.
Yeah.
And things are a little bit different now as well. Like where in the past, like because of certain burial practices and the way that we did things and customs, you know, people would be laid out for days on end. So they would have an option to be, you know, or come back to life. And when I say come back to life, seemingly come back to life, afterthought, you know, to have died, you know, they might be suffering from catalepsy or some type of, you know, diabetic coma or something that we didn't really understand back then. But then, you know, things changed. We started embalming. And once you're embalmed, that's it. Like, you're definitely not coming back. Like, once you're, if you're in...
No one's woken up embalmed.
No, you're not coming back with that kind of thing. But a lot of people in the past were buried alive. Like, we know this now. And because
from the scratch marks on top of the coffin.
Scratch marks and even more disturbing things like funeral.
What's the author's name again?
So, it's Rodney Davies.
And there's like a million books called Buried Alive.
Oh,
yeah. Trying to find the cover.
There's a whole heap of these books. Yeah,
you've got to give me the pictures of the covers before we do these shows now.
Okay, we can start doing that. Geez, I'm glad we're not recording this in when we are test recording it in video, but now I'm covered in soy sauce from my Thai curry, and it's all over my shirt, it's all over my pants, and I was trying to go down to the bathroom, and it just looks like I've soiled myself. So that was fun.
Just stand up so we can get a little
there
shot.
Go. Yeah, there you go. Like, look at this. Look at this.
Nice.
Just great.
Nice crotch.
Yeah, put my crotch right up into the camera. So
I'll just mention now that this video is actually going out.
No, it's not.
The show we hope to launch will be next Friday, but I'm going to put this video in the post. So you'll still be able to go back.
Tell me. You just go ahead and do it. So you don't tell me. And I just sat up and put my crotch.
It was
like,
funny.
I just put my crotch up and like just did the time warp.
It was funny. Huh? It's still funny. It was more funny when you spilled the Thai food all over you.
Yeah, and then I open up this can of coffee and the can of coffee just explodes all over me. I'm going to get into my car tonight. It's going to blow up on me. Things happen in threes. Actually, the whole thing's happening in threes is a recurring theme in this book by Rodney Davies. But do you want me to just jump into this?
Yeah, and then jump in. I'll do the Nurgles in the plus extension.
Okay. All right. Okay, jeez, I feel, even though we've been recording, I feel exposed. Here we go.
You are exposed. You just exposed yourself. on the video.
Okay, so here we go. Let's talk about the origins, actually. Once again, you know, people that talk about these sorts of stories and their experiences, and he actually was terrified. And this is Rodney Davies, the author of this book. He was terrified himself at a young age into this topic and understanding these concepts, right? Because he lived above a mortuary.
Oh, wow.
He grew up above a mortuary. Mm. And he said that, you know, as a young boy, he saw the terrible things that, you know, went past. Like, he never saw anything gory, but it was just death. Like, it was just death, although he appreciated the workmanship of certain, you know, the coffins and the marble and this kind of stuff. And, of course, there's an art to this, you know, so I get that. But he has this early experience of where he wandered down into a workshop or something like that where they were constructing a coffin of some kind. And he gets in and he accidentally breaks something. I don't know if it was a wooden lathe or something. It's not really relevant, but he breaks it. And one of the guys that's working there kind of plays a game with him because he thought he'd be funny. So he climbed into an open coffin. And this guy to this little boy says something along the lines of, "Oh, you little so-and-so, you broke my lathe," grabs hold of the coffin lid and then slams it down and starts hammering it down.
Oh,
right?
No, that's scary.
He's a kid. Yeah. He's absolutely terrified.
That'll wreck you for life.
Yeah, absolutely it did. So that's already in his mind. He then says later on, as he started to grow, that his bedroom actually somehow had view of the corpse room. Or of the mortuary, essentially. So he would see bodies going in and out, and he used to cover himself with bed sheets at night because he would be just so, you know, horrified by what he was seeing. But, you know, this really did expose him to, you know, the idea that, you know, his anxieties are not groundless, he writes, because some people are supposed to be dead, are really asleep, immobilized from trance, in a coma, experiencing catalepsy, and their misdiagnosis can actually lead to a horrifying fate in the extreme. And like the review, he actually says, "Do not read this if you have a nervous disposition or have trouble sleeping, because I want everyone to rest in peace."
This is going to have some shocking stories in it. A little bit cringy.
So let's, like, the first story is horrible. Like, it's absolutely horrible because there has always been, it's called PAB. No, sorry, PBA, mm-hmm. Going back to front, which is premature burial anxieties. And this is especially back in the 1600s, well into the 1800s.
Because there was a high chance of it happening.
There's a high chance that you would fall into, you know, some type of stupor or people having catalepsy, paralysis, you know, a temporary paralysis, all that kind of stuff. And you'd be buried because you'd have people that say, "Oh, no, you're dead. Yeah, you're dead." And people would be buried. And as I pointed out, and you pointed out before, like, there's been plenty of times where coffins, for whatever reason, have been dug back up, whether they're doing construction. There's plenty of those cases where they're doing construction and they find, you know, the coffin open and there's scratch marks on it or something's broken. That people came up with a whole range of different apparatuses, devices, you know, technologies, so that if they do come to in the coffin, that they can get out.
The string and the bell, that's the old one, right?
That wasn't
mentioned. Is that just a myth?
I don't even know if that's a myth, right? Because that was mentioned, that wasn't even mentioned in the book. But I remember years ago we did, a ghost tour, and someone told us that it was like the origin of the dead ringers. Mm. It's like, but I don't even know if that's true. I don't know if that was just some weird Victorian patent that was put out. But in this particular book, he said what people would do is they would take precautions and drastic actions. So one of the opening stories is like, look, there was a Virginian family in the 1850s and the farmer's daughter died or seemingly died. And so they had this plan of how to, you know, ensure that they don't wake up inside a coffin. So he plunged a dagger directly into her bosom and she woke up screaming and subsequently died as a result of this thing being, you know, sword or, you know, dagger being plunged into her chest.
Well, at least she wasn't buried alive.
So other people would do things like they would be buried with vials of poison. One woman asked to be buried with a handgun, but they stopped doing that because grave robbers would come and steal the handguns. There's any number of odd contraptions and machines to signal that they aren't actually dead 6 feet under. There was a Mrs. Penenord, and she was a wealthy agriculturalist who in 1908, designed and built her own tomb. Her coffin had air holes and all, and she even had a telephone installed in the headrest with a line to the house of the cemetery keeper. So that if she's accidentally declared dead, she could just go, "Hello, I'm not dead.
Sorry to bother you and all.
Yes, can you come out and dig me up, please?
I'm not dead."
But look, you know, he says that when apparent death is mistaken for actual death, the results may be absolutely catastrophic and lead to post-living horrors. And such ghastly experiences have occurred all too frequently in the past and regretfully still occur to this day. So you know, he points out the other histories about how people in the past tried to, you know, confirm that someone was dead. So it wasn't as extreme as plunging a dagger into someone's chest. It was also things like, you know, thrusting needles into the skin, applying clamps to people's nipples and sensitive regions. And hot coals applied to the feet, vicious slaps of the most intense kind across people's faces.
And, it's because you hire someone for the nipple clamping and vicious slaps?
Oh, I'm sure.
Generally, a family member would do it.
Wasn't the Marquis de Sade like some type of sexual deviant? I'm sure that's probably what yeah, he would be doing. Oh, you know, he would have people paying for it, I'm sure. But there was also like opium, for example, caused a considerable amount of problems with people being misdiagnosed as being dead. So there's this story from 1746 where a coffin lid was accidentally broken by a labourer. And this is what I was referring to before about there being construction of some kind. And so there was the Bromwich Church, which was having a vestry installed, like this additional part, you know, renovation built onto the church. And this poor man, Mr. Whitehouse, had consumed large quantities of opiates, right? And he was found to be dead. Like they thought he was dead. So they buried him. But of course, when they were digging and this coffin lid was broken, they found that 22 years later, that he actually wasn't dead when he was buried.
How did they know?
Because the coffin was torn apart on the inside.
Right.
Like he had, like, you obviously gone to the point of like ripping back his fingernails of just what he had done. But, you know, when looking at the records that, yeah, he had consumed an excessive amount of opiates, of drugs, especially the depressant sort, which opiates are, they thought he was dead. And essentially the coffin indicated a post-death struggle had enveloped. So, yeah, not too nice. Then there's cases from the early years of the 18th century. This story is of a Dr. Jacobus Winslow, who witnessed this event when he was a young man. So apparently the conveyor of the story said his father and several other onlookers were present when an exhumation had taken place at a cemetery of a Parisian church. Inside was a Franciscan monk, right? He'd been buried 3 to 4 days earlier. Now, the reason why they dug him up is because the monk apparently was found in his cell, dead, cold, and he was buried almost immediately. This is what the practice was. Mm. But word about his passing got back to the previous priory or wherever he was before, and the other monks were like, just be careful because, he suffers from cataleptic seizures. And so they tried to dig him up, and of course was found to still be alive. But he died soon after, obviously, from the
He died from anger. He was so pissed off.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. Like, people not only are pissed off, they're also terrified. Could you imagine? Like, it's just something that's just too horrible to contemplate. But then you have a more recent report. You've got, this is from 1996 with Maureen Jones. She's 59 years old and she's a diabetic. Now, she fell into a hypoglycemic coma at her cottage in Humberside. And apparently, this coma was so profound that she had not awoken the next day. She didn't have any family living with her, but her elder son, Neil, found her clad in her nightclothes and he called for the GP. So the GP comes along, he inspects her, he finds that she has no heartbeat, no pulse, no signs of breath. I don't know what methods he used to determine this. Like when I was talking about those other methods earlier, at some point there were things employed, such as like placing a saucer of water on someone's chest.
What's that going to do?
And then seeing, well, you put like a drop of water and you see if the drop of water moved, because if their chest, you know, exhales inhales, then it would move. But for so many of these people, so many of these reports, their breath is just so shallow that even that wouldn't reveal anything. But in this, you know, particular circumstance with Maureen Jones, it was determined that she was dead. So they notified the funeral company, and 30 minutes later, the undertaker arrived, and so did PC Kevin Smith, right? Now, his name comes up later on. It's interesting because he was attending this routine death call, and as soon as he got there, he noticed that her leg twitched. It was like a momentary thing. Like no one else could have even caught this. It was just such a flash in the pan moment that he immediately started CPR and she gasped for breath and made a full recovery.
Wow.
But as I pointed out, she had been seemingly dead for at least 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Now,
seemingly dead.
Seemingly dead, right?
So that doesn't mean dead.
Well, hang on a second. I should say confirmed dead for 30 minutes.
How
by
confirmed?
A doctor. Because a doctor attended and he confirmed that she was dead.
The doctor.
Well, yeah, who knows?
Drinky.
It's 1996, so maybe not that bad. But then, of course, death has a sense of humor as well. So Davis writes about this equally startling recovery that occurred in Paris in the 19th century. And this is really intriguing. It's about a lot of these stories, right, as much as they're very much materialistic mm-hmm. and they're based on science and they're based on just matter of fact of what occurred and what happened, there's these elements of coincidence that are kind of in here. There's these elements, and of course, you know, things like out-of-body experiences, apparitions, that kind of stuff comes up much later in the book. But of course, all this kind of stuff would occur, but also near-death experiences, you know, because these people are technically, you know, recorded as being dead and they come back. And many of them, you know, many of these reports don't include any details of a near-death experience, but there are a few in there, which would make sense. It's actually consistent with
that.
Well, I was only just saying recently, wasn't it like only one in, I'm sorry, it's like 30% of people that are returned from death or from, you know, near death have a near death experience.
Yeah,
exactly. So with this particular case, this is from Zaire Martel. She was 21 years old. It's 1836. She's an actress and she collapses on stage. She just collapses on stage. You know, they call it if there's a doctor in the house. This doctor comes up and pronounces her dead. And they put her in a coffin. But they leave the coffin open and she lays there for 2 days so weeping mourners can pay their respects. Now, finally, the funeral director, you know, they make the decision to, you know, nail down the coffin and they start banging the coffin in. And within the first nail being hammered into that coffin, it startles her from her deathly lethargy.
Lucky.
She's given restoratives. She recovers 2 days later and once again on stage. She lived again for another 49 years.
She went straight back on stage.
Straight back on stage. 2 days later, she lived for another 49 years to 1885. But here's the odd coincidence, right? And considering, you know, her means of arousal, Martel means hammer.
Oh, wow.
So just, I don't know. It's just a weird, subtle nod where maybe, you know, we're reading into it, but it is like, when you look at many of these stories, it seems to be there's this odd element to them. There's these odd occurrences. So speaking of hammers, there's also a story or an incident that occurred in Burgundy during the plague epidemic. Now, there's no date given for this particular event, but it was reportedly, it occurred to a man by the name of Nathaniel Wanley. Now, he was from an aristocratic family, and apparently he died from the dreaded infection. But what we do know now, which wasn't really acknowledged back then, is that there's a comatose state of the plague. And apparently with the plague, depending on where it gets into your lymph nodes and the course of progression that the disease takes, some people will go into this comatose state and they will either live or die. It's like this kind of decision-making stage that occurs. And, you know, he wasn't dumped into a plague pit, which happens. And there's a few of these stories, you know, in this book where people...
You wake up in a plague pit.
You know why? Because they're drunk. There's stories, right, of during, you know, European Black Death times of where people go to the local publican house. They get roaring drunk, so they must be Australian. And they come wandering out and they pass out in the street and the plague carts with the bell and, you know, bring out your dead. They all rock up and they find a drunk guy lying in the street. They think he's dead. They throw him up, you know, onto the cart and they throw him into a plague pit. And there's at least two reports in there of people coming to in a plague pit.
What the hell?
You know, with awful, you know, circumstances associated with it, but surviving, like getting out of it and surviving. But going back to Nathaniel and his story. So because he was an aristocrat, they placed him in a coffin and they took the coffin 4 miles from his home. Now they put him into a barn. And I think there were some weather conditions. That's another thing that comes up with many of these circumstantial cases of where, like, the weather seems to play a role in their survival. Now, maybe it's just, I'll give you a great example.
Obviously, if it's too cold, they're going to die of the elements.
There's a really great example. So there's a great example of a man, which I'll mention later on, but an Indian guy who was saved by a downpour of rain. By a monsoon. It actually, even though they thought he was dead, a monsoon occurred and it ended up saving his life. It did cause him to wander around naked for about 30 years, but, which I will explain, I'll come back to. So with this guy, this Nathaniel, you know, he is put into the barn. They start hammering down the lid. And when they hammer down the lid, they notice blood start falling from the seams of the coffin.
Oh my gosh.
And so they open up the coffin and here's the guy wide awake trying to get out. The accidental piercing of his shoulder by that nail had released him from a deep slumber.
Oh, wow.
They warmed him slowly near a fire and he went on to marry and father children and grandchildren.
He didn't die of tetanus.
He didn't die of tetanus as far as I'm aware, no. I mean, he may have, but not for a very, very, very long time. Like the guy was, you know, it's just amazing though, the fact that, because obviously there's no standardized methods back then either of determining what death, you know, really is. And this is why I'm saying it's this gray zone. And you might like to think it for in modern times, you know, with our, you know, scientific instruments and being able to monitor brainwave activity and all that kind of stuff. As our resurrection science gets better, and this is it, like we, you know, even CPR now, you know, would be considered to be some type of, you know, magical thing back in the 1800s, 1600s. But now it's like we start going, well, what is exactly the point of death? You know, how long after someone has experienced brain death can we actually resuscitate them with the type of technologies that we have, the new medications that we have?
Well, that's why I mentioned, you know, people getting swamped by an avalanche and then being recovered days later, because last time we spoke about this on the show, they're the cases that we spoke about. It was that tourist, where was he from? There was a guy that was covered years ago in snow and it was 3 days or something. They couldn't find him on the mountain. And yeah, he was just so frozen, they were able to bring him back, which led to all these, you know, developments in cold, resurrection technology, as you call it.
Yeah. I mean, cold plays a huge role in these sorts of stories of people coming back to life. But I'll get back to that in a second. You know, he points out, Davies, look, plague wasn't the only purveyor of premature burial. There was also typhus, tuberculosis, you know, these acute viral infections, you know, commonly associated with high fevers, hallucinations, loss of consciousness, which is often easily mistaken for the end. You know, and so this kind of stuff was common. But strangely enough, with smallpox, right, something was noted in 1784. So I think it was typhus at the time. John Howard wrote in his report, The State of Prisons in England, called it jail fever. This was the state of prisons in England and Wales. And it was called jail fever because you know, typhus just spread through. And typhus was in concentration camps during the Second World War. You know, it's a truly horrible illness. And some of the stories that I've heard people describe with this is the hallucinations, particularly concentration camps are horrible because when people were starving, they would suffer from typhus and they would go into these high fevers. And I think there was a woman by the name of Kitty Hart. You know, she survived being in Auschwitz, and she said that she got typhus. And when she got typhus, she saw all these beautiful like treats and food at the end of her bed, and she almost ended up getting, you know, taken for selection because she was like trying to reach down and grabbing these foods, and it was causing her to yell out and scream and really horrible. Like it's really horrible what this disease does. But with typhus and smallpox, you know, observers, medical observers started to notice that a sudden change in temperature could cause arousal from people suffering from, you know, whether or not it was the high fever state or the hallucinatory state. When you splashed people with cold water, it would cause some type of resurrection. And this started to take on, like this started to catch on later on, because then we head, you know, well into the future. We head to the 5th of April of 1996 once again, and we come to this story of, look, what irresponsible parents, you know, by the way, this story of a three-year-old girl that's walking her dog in a pond in St. Helens and Merseyside. So this is in England. She's walking a dog and, I mean, three-year-old walking a dog near a pond, right?
Yeah, that's nuts.
Guess what she does?
Falls in.
She goes in. She goes into the water like a typical what a three-year-old would do. Apparently, you know, she
probably follows the dog or something.
Well, the dog was sitting by this. And the reason why attention was drawn to this is because a passerby had gone by before and had seen her with the dog. And when they'd come back, they saw the dog just sitting next to the lake or next to this, you know, water, this pond with all of her clothes folded up. And they realized that something must have happened. So, yeah, she was obviously in a great deal of trouble. They called the police. Guess who shows up? PC Kevin Smith, the same PC that showed up to Maureen, who was suffering from the diabetic coma.
All right.
And he resuscitated her. So it's weird. So he comes, he finds this poor girl face down in the water, lifeless. And we know that she was underwater. She was completely submerged for at least half an hour. At least half an hour. She made a full recovery. They pulled her out of the water.
Yeah, right.
You know why she made a full recovery?
Because it was cold.
Temperature.
Yeah. So I was just asking GPT what it had in store, and it mentioned a Swedish woman named Anna Bagenholm. She was trapped under a layer of ice in freezing water for 80 minutes back in 1999, but rescuers got to her, they resuscitated her, and she was fine. Her heart started again. Yeah,
amazing?
She didn't have any brain damage, and yeah, they attribute it to the cold, obviously.
Yeah. It's seemingly like the cold must slow down those biological processes, the chemical reactions that are taking place. It has a neuroprotective effect. You know, it's we don't entirely understand it from what I was reading earlier today. Like we've got a very good understanding of it, but there's elements of it that are still kind of elusive to us. But the whole cold thing, it comes up again and again and again. And in fact, you know, Davies writes that there's several instances on record of people being successfully revived after being submerged for much longer periods. So there's a remarkable case that comes from the 18th century from Sweden. This was reported by Dr. Joel Langelot to the German Academy. Apparently it relates to a 65-year-old gardener who was at the Royal Palace in Trondheim. Now, he tried to assist a man who had fallen into a lake. This guy, this gardener, he couldn't swim and the lake is frozen over. So he goes out and tries to rescue this guy, but the ice breaks from underneath him. His legs get tangled in the reeds or whatever's there and he sinks to the bottom. Apparently, he was underwater for 16 hours.
16 hours?
16 hours.
Wow. And
the only reason
the 80 minutes was impressive from the Swedish.
Well, and the thing is, the only reason why we found him, he reported that he got hit in the head with a crook of some kind. It was because they were sticking this hook, like this crook thing, into the water trying to find him. And that brought him back after 16 hours. And the doctors, all they could say was that, look, there was air trapped in his mouth, perhaps, and because of the freezing temperatures and his lungs being clear of water, they warmed him gradually and, you know, this is how he survived. And of course, now we understand that warming people slowly is the way to treat hypothermia. So maybe that's why he survived. But 16 hours, like, that's an incredible amount of time. It's nothing, according to the records.
No.
It's nothing.
There can't be longer than that.
I'll wait for it, right? So if you believe a report from roughly 1604, no exact date is given, but there's a woman by the name of Margaret Ladsdotter. So she fell into a Swedish fjord. What is it with these Swedes falling into water? Is that a Swedish thing?
They're hardy people.
So she falls in, right? She was submerged for 3 days. 3 days.
No.
And when she was finally rescued, she made a full recovery and lived to 75 years of age. Although the exact details of how she survived are not provided. However, she also managed to survive two other drowning incidents.
What's going on?
They were much shorter duration. I'm like, three attempts at drowning? Did death just give up? Is that what death is? Oh, I've tried to drown her twice.
The boats were a bit rickety back then. No life jackets. She couldn't swim.
So
she lived right near a fjord and couldn't swim.
Imagine that. Just irresponsible, really. So the ability to survive immersion is well known from modern cases as well. And yeah, you've just mentioned one of those cases there. But there was a man known as the Fisherman. Right. This is kind of a side story, but I like this.
What was his profession?
Fishing people out of the water.
Oh, right.
So what he would do, his name was John Jeremy. He was still of Stillwater,
Ron
Minnesota.
Jeremy, huh?
Yes, Ron Jeremy. Such for editing. John Jeremy. And he was from Stillwater in Minnesota, and he possessed a magical ability to resuscitate people. He's said to have retrieved 500 people that were apparently lifeless and resuscitated them. From the
500
water. 500
people.
500, right?
I wonder if he got the nickname.
Well, his method, this is nothing though, because his uncle is recorded to have rescued 1,000 people. And these people would be underwater for a long period of time. And he had been offered large sums of money for his method, but he kept it to himself. He claims that this was a secret family method that had been closely guarded and passed down through the generations.
What?
And in 1926, he passed away, but not before passing the secret to his nephew, George Lawrence. So I don't know what this is. Like,
and what did George Lawrence do? You can't leave it at George Lawrence.
It's not revealed, but I'm wondering, is it not revealed? Did he want to keep it secret because perhaps it had unconventional Chapter 1 elements to it?
Well, maybe he kept it secret for his secret society.
Well, the reason why I say that is because we go to Passy in France, the 24th of July, 1757, when a 21-year-old waterman, which I'm assuming is like maybe, like a gondola, operator or something like that, he fell into the river, was carried out by the current and drowned. He was submerged for over half an hour. This is in records. This is in written records. Everyone thought that he had died until a physician happened to be coming past and came up with a fantastic idea. He blew a great deal of tobacco smoke into his anus with a straw. The man very soon gave sign of life and recovered well enough to speak with smoke emanating from his
mouth. Classic.
Okay, well, the last part I actually added there, but yeah. I guess imagine it though. Some pervert doctor comes...
I don't have the rest
right.
of it.
Some pervert doctor comes along and is like, oh, look, we must blow huge amounts of smoke into that young man's rectum. And people are like, will that resuscitate him? Like, resuscitate?
Yeah. Yeah, what's the reasoning? How does that work?
I have no idea how
Why
that
would
works.
You try that end first? Smoke in the other end?
I think that happened. I only briefly mentioned there, but you're right. We have looked into that story. And I think he actually put smoke into all orifices.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That was the idea. You just smoked them out.
Although trying to get into the eye of his penis was the hardest part. But I come to the incredible story of François de Saville. François de Saville is just, he truly is what I would consider to be like the living equivalent of, what was that movie that was all those people kept on avoiding death?
Die Hard.
No, it wasn't Die Hard. It's where death kept on chasing them because they would, no, see, you're pushing the name of the movie out of my head. Ah, I can't even think of the name of it now.
The Cube.
No, it wasn't The Cube. You're just loving this and being on camera. This is how he treats me.
Right. The Sound of Music.
No, it wasn't The Sound of Music. Regardless, essentially this guy, right? So Francois, we go to France, the 16th century. It's April 1537 in the town of Rouen. And there's a pregnant wife of a Huguenot nobleman. And this is Saville, right? His wife is about to give birth, but he's away on business. And in his absence, she gets sick and sadly dies, right? Now, the nobleman returns. He comes back and he finds out that his wife has died, and immediately he orders her exhumation. Like, immediately. Mm. He's like, why did you bury her? I want to see her. This is insane. And so her coffin is exhumed, and they find that there is a living child in the coffin still breathing.
Oh, my gosh.
This is François de Saville, right? So they bring him out. And he lives like a long, happy life. Like I shouldn't say it's that happy, but essentially like he grows up. He grows up as a young man. But later in life, he finds himself a deputy in Normandy. And he's a Protestant, right? This group is Protestants, but they're being persecuted by Catholics. And in 1562, Charles IX and his Catholic soldiers besiege Rouen, this town, right? And this is the stronghold of the Saville clan. And essentially the Saville clan, a whole heap of tragedies essentially happen, but Francois is shot in the cheek and in the neck, and he falls into a ditch and he's dead. He's covered with earth and that's it for him. We think that's the end of his story, but he's so horribly maimed by this that later on his manservant or valet comes searching for him, right? Well, he comes with the smoke ready to go.
Where are you, me lord?
And well, he did. That's exactly what was going on. He's looking for him and they can't find him, but he comes across this pit where these two men, so essentially when he'd been shot, he'd been thrown in, Francois had been thrown in, and this guy had been thrown in over the top of him. And he finds them and he pulls them both out, and they're so badly affected by blood and the dirt and everything else that this valet or this servant doesn't recognize his master at all. So he throws them both back into the pit and covers it over. And as he covers it over, he sees a hand sticking out of the ground. So he goes back to go and cover up the hand, right? And as he goes to stamp on the hand and cover it up, he realizes that there's this very unique shaped diamond ring on his hand. He's like, oh, that's the ring of my master. So he pulls him out and realizes that he is the master, right? He's still breathing. He's still alive.
Ow.
Like, that's the thing. He's still alive. He said there's a very subtle warmth to him. So they take him back and they try to resuscitate him. Blow smoke up his ass, and he's resuscitated. He's barely alive. Yeah, he's barely alive. Great, ready to go. That's perfect. He's barely alive, but he remains unanimated for 5 days. For 5 days.
So
he's
unconscious. Just
unconscious, seemingly on the point of death before he has this raging fever. And he starts to recover. He recovers like a man coming out of a deep sleep. Sadly, on the 26th of October, Charles' Catholic troops attack once again. They raid this particular location where Francois is being kept, but they treat him kindly, and the valet there throws Francois onto a straw mattress and into a back room when Francois had made enemies amongst these other soldiers. And so another group of soldiers come looking for the brother of Francois.
Right.
And they don't find him. Like, it was reported that he was there, but they don't find him. But they find this, you know, deathly Francois. So they throw him out a window, right? They throw him out this third, fourth story window. It's actually quite high for the time.
Efficient.
When they throw him out the window, his fall is broken by a pile of dung.
Oh, God.
Like a massive pile of dung, where he lays dead in the dung for 3 days, exposed to the elements. But guess what? He was he recovered.
Is his manservant rescuing?
No, apparently a Catholic relative calls at the house and found the wretched man clinging onto whatever life he had left, giving him water and bread, but finding that the cold night had broken his fever. He's then moved to a chateau 3 miles down the road where he caught a cold almost dying once again, he's taken in by two brother healers who allow him to recover for 6 weeks. And in August of 1563, he's restored to a semblance of reasonable health. And in 1583, he goes to England, where he meets up with other healers, which the story is not included. We don't find out how, but some miraculous healers, where he makes a miraculous full recovery. So the guy was born
tough
dead,
old bastard.
Thrown out a window, had a terrible cold, almost died three times, like buried, and he managed to survive.
He had a lot of karmic debt to pay off, obviously. Oh, definitely.
Well, that's the thing, right? But then, of course, there's this diamond element that comes up. And, you know, speaking of the diamond ring on the hand, grave robbers start to go out. And there's lots of stories where people, you know, in these times, in the old country, would obviously be, you know, buried with their rings and in their jewelry. And so in the 1500s, 1600s, you had grave robbers. And it was even before, you know, like anatomy and that kind of stuff. Of course, we know from the 1800s, which I've got some of those stories coming up in a moment, where grave robbers would go and steal fresh corpses, which was a danger in itself, apparently, but I'll get to that. But there were a whole heap of grave diggers that ended up terrifying themselves after they went to go and perhaps fortuitously go and rob certain graves. So you've got Cologne, 1571. You've got Rheinmark Aldock, who was the wife of a magistrate. She was infected with plague and buried with her favorite ring. Grave diggers dug her up, you know, her coffin, start twisting the ring off her hand, which reanimates her, and clad in a shroud that she was buried in, grabs hold of the grave robber's lantern and ventures home through the streets. People think she's a wraith, because she's, you know, got this shawl on and this lantern as she's going along, and
far out.
It's just incredible, right? These sorts of stories are repeated over and over and over. It's because these grave robbers do something to their bodies, like wrenching jewelry off
them. Yeah, wake them up.
Which wakes them up. You've got the mother of a Baron of Ponant. This is also a Huguenot nobleman. And she apparently choked on a chicken bone and was immediately buried with her five rings. Apparently, she was quite a bitch. Like, she was very horrible to people that worked on her property. And so these grave robbers that came to go and, you know, steal the jewelry off her hand, because they knew that she'd been buried it within the middle of the night, one of them gives her a slap, like slaps her across the face, and is like, yeah, that serves you right. It reanimates her, in which she sits up and the man ran off in terror. She also then gave birth in the coffin to Baron.
What? Oh, my God.
How terrifying is this stuff, right?
Are you going to do the necrophilia chapter in PLUS?
There's only one story. There is necrophilia that does come up. I will
pay extra.
You got to pay extra for that. I'll just pick up the book. You know, it's pretty cheap. It's on Amazon. I will actually mention that story, but I won't go there just yet. I want to tell you actually about how weather seemingly has saved people. So you've got this story.
Yeah, I want to hear about this Indian guy that's walking around naked for 30 years.
Well, this was Kumar Rajendra. So Kumar Rajendra, this happened in May of 1909. And he had been, I don't know if he was at some ball or some Bollywood thing. I don't know.
Some Bollywood thing.
Whatever.
He was Indian. It must have been some Bollywood thing.
No, it was like some dancing thing. And he.
That's even worse.
Whatever. It's terrible.
He was at a dancing Bollywood thing. He was eating curry.
He was at a scam call center, randomly calling Australian mobile phones.
He was trying to scam Benjamin.
Telling me that he was from Microsoft support.
He was eating curry at the Swari contest for Bollywood, calling Benjamin Grundy in his lunch break, trying to scam him out of an Amazon membership fee.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was doing, right? And he died. Like, he suffered a state of catalepsy or something had happened. And he died at this dance. Now, his wife wanted him cremated because this is more of a cultural thing that happened. And they would get these big funeral pyres out.
Yeah.
And so they got all these pyres out, and this particular pyre ready to go and ready to light it up. And they put him on top of it, but this terrible, you know, typhoon, you know, monsoon came through, and the rain was so much that they couldn't light the pyre. And they just left his body up because they all went running inside because it was just that heavy. And look, the guy's dead, so it's fine. And so they leave him outside, and they come back the following day, you know, to light the pyre, and he's gone. Like, he's disappeared, right?
Not washed away.
No, he's just gone. There's nowhere to be found. Like, the body is no longer there. Now, we don't know anything about this until 1921. So this is 1909. Mm. We don't find out about this until 1921. He claims that the heavy rain restored him to consciousness, where, with no recollection of who he was or where he was, stumbled away from the pyre. He wandered into the forest, where he found a group of naked forest-dwelling Hindu medicine men.
What?
Pardon me? Who take him in who take him in. And
you look like you're a bit wet, buddy.
Yeah, pretty much. And so they take this guy in, and he stays there, and he becomes a beggar. And it was in 1921 where a former friend recognizes this wretched naked beggar in the street.
Why wouldn't he return to his family?
Because he had no recollection of who he was.
Oh, he's got
he had none. Like, he's got complete amnesia. And they realized that this beggar was actually a prince. And so his memory is restored by his friend, like sparks something in his memory, and this memory comes back. And it took until 1946 for the High Court to actually recognize him and restore him to his rightful position in society.
There was a story I read similar to this that occurred in China. It was like the 1990s in China. Remember I was doing a couple of those China stories on a Plus episode months back?
Yep.
It was one of those, but I never got to mention it. But it was a similar thing where a family had lost a child when the child was quite young, and he had just basically wandered off and they couldn't find him. It was like a missing persons case. And then it was like years later, this they find some guy who's lost his memory. He's now in his 20s, but he looks so familiar. The family thinks this might be our lost son.
Yeah, I recall that now. Yeah.
And they end up taking him in, and he's a little bit mentally retarded. So when they ask him, he's like, yeah, you're my family, but he's never quite 100% clear. And he ends up staying with them, living with them. And they welcome him as the lost, you know, son from the family. And then they do a DNA test. It's just some random guy. It's not him at all.
Oops. Oh, dear.
And then there was, I have to do it on the next show, because there was some weird twist where another guy turned up and it was the missing son. I've got to go find that story.
Yeah, I have to go and find that now. Okay, so let's go to the Resurrection Men. So this is the 1840s. And up until, I think there was an Anatomy Act. I've got it here somewhere. Where is it? The Anatomy Act of 1832. This is what in England made it illegal to snatch bodies, or much harder to snatch bodies. But up until that point, it was like pretty much a free-for-all for grabbing bodies. But graveyards in England were meant, you know, for example, for like 1,000 people.
Mm.
They had 80,000 people in them. And they couldn't understand why. And it was because there was like nighttime resurrection men in the 1840s that were going in and they were digging up people that had been just freshly buried and incinerating them, which back then was a big deal.
Like, who would pay for that?
Well, exactly. You know, that's a very good... Well, they must have been making money from the internment, and then and they could keep it going. The cemetery was only for 1,000 people.
Just to keep the cemetery going.
Yeah, it's basically a cemetery Ponzi scheme. And but also what they would do is they'd supply fresh corpses to medical establishments.
But how would that work? Because you'd have the gravestone. So it's not like eventually you're going to run out of space for gravestones. Like if you remove a body, the people who buried them there are going to go, well, the gravestone's still there. I mean, I don't understand the scam.
I don't understand how it works either, but they must have had a way. I mean, they've been doing it for a long time, so they must have had a way. So they've got, you know, the body snatchers like Burke and Hare, who apparently murdered people to provide fresh corpses. You know, that kind of stuff was happening. But then you come to the story of the student John McIntyre. And this is amazing. Like, this is an amazing story. This is in 1824. This poor kid, like, I don't know how old he was, but he couldn't have been more than 21, 22. He worked himself into a state of complete and utter exhaustion because he was going to medical school, right? You can imagine medical school, which already is hard enough, but in 1824, it must be pretty hard. He gets put to bed one evening and he further deteriorates until the point where he falls into a catalepsy and is confirmed dead, right?
Yeah.
And so he's dead, he's laid out, but he claims that he's fully aware of everything that is going on around him. He can't open his eyes because he's completely paralyzed. But after 4 days of lying out there, he's nailed down into a coffin. He's conveyed to a local cemetery. He hears each hammer blow ringing through his head. He hears this thunderous sound above him, which is the soil and the earth obviously coming onto the coffin. And he spends several hours in abject terror inside this coffin, unable to move, only hearing. It's amazing in these reports how hearing always seems to be the one thing that never goes with them.
Yeah.
And I have heard that hearing with, you know, bodily faculties towards the point of death is always the last thing to go.
And obviously he was breathing, but again, just so shallow.
So shallow that it doesn't matter, right? But a few hours later, possibly, he's not entirely sure of how long it took, he hears men's voices and the crashing of wood and crowbars coming through. And he's pulled up out of the grave. It's grave robbers. Right, they've come to take this fresh corpse. His eyes are finally opened up. Like, they pull his eyes open and he realizes he's lying on this marble slab in the very medical school that he was going to.
No. Oh, right? My God.
Now, there's students all around. He feels his body being poked and prod. And his teachers this day happened to be carrying out an electrical experiment. Now, a lot of these stories come up, you know, and there's like a whole chapter in here on people being, you know, electrocuted and being applied with Leyden jars and that kind of stuff. But on this particular day, they take an electrode and insert it into a certain bodily orifice and attach another, you know, some type of electrode to his ear or something and animate him. He says that once they attached the wires to my body, a million lights exploded before my eyes and I sat up and looked about. So he's just like... Yeah, he's just like looking about. And they think though, because I've done this experiment multitudes of times, it's just like the response of the muscles responding to the electricity. So he's just like,
oh, right.
He's like,
oh, God.
Just in a state of like terrible horror. But he's screaming out and it suddenly stops. And so they go to run the experiment once again, but they stop for whatever. For some reason, this doctor's like, no, they go to apply a scalpel to him. And with the very last bit of energy that he has, maybe it came from the electricity, he screams out. Like, he actually manages to scream out and they realize he's no longer hooked up to anything. So like, oh, this guy's alive.
Oh my gosh.
And he was. He was resurrected. But it was because of his body being snatched by these grave robbers that he actually survived. Had he not been grave robbed, he wouldn't have he wouldn't have survived.
Yeah, those grave robbers did a real service.
Well, that's the thing. Like, these grave robbers, they get this, like, really bad rap. And, like, maybe they're not that bad at all. Like, maybe they're not that bad. Okay, they are pretty bad. Okay. I'm sure that's going to end up as a gift somewhere. Anyway, body snatching was legal before 1832, although you could be lynched by an angry mob, writes Davies. But, of course, you know, it was also dangerous. As a resurrection man, you could actually be killed or injured. And we go to Aberdeen, September of 1784, where this young woman dies. Apparently, she was this beautiful young woman, and the grave diggers like had this soft spot for her. I guess being a grave digger, you know, screwing corpses is the next, you know, possible path. But he felt sorry for this young girl, and in her late teens. And these surgeons come along and they're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to cut that up. And they bribe the grave digger and they say, look, just, you know, tell us which grave it is. You know, just, you know, we'll give it a few hours and we'll come back and we'll dig her up. And so this grave digger takes the money, but is actually pissed off and tells them, oh, yeah, it's that grave over there. This is the grave of a woman who had died 4 months previously, right? He just figured that she would be so putrefied that they couldn't use it for any of their anatomy research or whatever. These grave diggers come along. These grave robbers come along. It's not the digger. It's the robbers that come along later on. They dig up this body. And despite the fact that it is too putrefied, they take it. They take this body, right? And it was reported in the Gentleman's Magazine of 1784.
Classic.
That the incident involved vapor-like flames of brimstone coming forth as they broke the lid. It suffocates them in an instant. It then released a gas, which was a combination suspected of being methane and hydrogen sulfide, that poisoned two passing women in the house. It brought a total of those killed to 11.
What the hell? It
so
killed
basically,
them?
Basically, the coffin blew up in the house and gassed everyone else.
Oh, my God.
So pretty dangerous, horrible times. Then you've got George Heywood, 1823, from Gloucestershire.
Anesthetist. But all this over some dead hua.
I knew that would come in handy.
There's the story. This is just actually a fortunate story, but it's George Heywood, 1823, Gloucestershire. He was working in a field. He was struck with a pitchfork. Right? Mm. And he went into a state of catalepsy and seemingly passed away. And he was buried. He was buried quite rapidly until two doctors at a pub or somewhere start having an argument over how this guy died. One was saying, oh, it was because the pitchfork penetrated his skull. That's what killed him. And the other, you know, doctor was like, oh, no, it was the sudden shock that caused it. And he's like, come on, little boy, let's have a fight about this. So they go and they dig the grave up.
Let's compare monocles.
They do. They go and dig the grave up, right? This is the point they're at. They go out there in the dark after having like a few beers. So they've got their Dutch courage on. They dig the grave up. The guy springs forth from the coffin because he wasn't dead. And they're like, oh, well, obviously nothing killed him. That's the tie, old boy. And they shake hands and away they go. So again, though, this subtle... repeated experiences, though, of where fate and coincidence seem to intervene in these things. And I think this is a really good example of two things, this book. One is the ultimate, I guess, power of the human spirit, to survive in this cloak, these clothes that we have of this body, right? And when it's your time to go, that's when it's your time to go, and not any time before.
Yeah, it also speaks to fate as well, especially some of the synchronicities with people.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And then, of course, you know, had these outlying stories of like John Smith, who was hanged at Tyburn. He actually survived being hung. And he spoke of that. And this is where the more paranormal elements, you know, and that sort of supernatural stuff comes up, where he says that when he was being hanged, he actually felt his spirit violently pressing upwards at the top of his skull, trying to escape.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. And where have we heard that before? We've heard plenty of reports of people describing that it's going up through the
going
sutures
out
of their
the
skull.
Top or going through the back.
Yeah.
The gate at the back.
Then you have the story from 1198 of Everardus Amble. So he was a German knight. And the story about this is that he fell sick and apparently died. You know, it's 1198. So we've got very, you know, few details to go on. But the story is that his wraith was taken from his body and he was carried away by evil spirits. They took him on this kind of Kentucky tour of Europe. They like took him to Jerusalem and then they took him down into Egypt, so, like all in that area.
So it's an NDE, OBE.
It's like an NDE, OBE kind of thing. He finds himself in Lombardy, and when he's in Lombardy, he's wandering through a field with these evil spirits, but they're people. And he runs into a friend, and his German friend is, you know, guten Tag and all happy to see him. And then finally goes to Rome. And he's never been to Rome before. And when all of a sudden he comes back, like he's suddenly awake and he's alive again. And he reports this story of what happened about these evil spirits taking him. But he's able to describe Rome in this incredible detail where he's never been there before. And people are like, oh, that's kind of weird. Like, what a weird coincidence that you're, you know, capable of doing that. It wasn't until later where, remarkably, his friend from the field who had seen him actually confirmed that he had met with him while he was dead, but had met with him and thought he was a physical, actual person and confirmed the details of what he was talking about. And he's like, no,
with him in Rome.
He met with him in real life, like afterwards, like after he'd come back, after, you know, being resurrected.
Oh, right.
He ran into his friend that while he was out of body and being escorted by these spirits, like his friend was like, oh, I just thought I was talking to you as a real person. Like, so very early examples of like possibly, you know, doppelganger kind of stuff, bilocation, yeah, in this case, out of body. But Davis himself, right? He's had his own experiences much later in life. When we go back again to 1996, you know, he's got two cases before. It's 1996, it's midnight, around midnight. He's lying in bed when he claims that as he starts to doze, he feels an arm being placed around his shoulders and this unmistakable pressure starts squeezing him before he receives an electric shock. Like, he gets this shock. And he says, although it's not, you know, as startling as one would think, because it seemingly is comforting. Like, there's this comforting feeling that comes about from it. Now, then he doesn't entirely know what it is until the next morning he finds out of the passing of his uncle. His uncle had died in a Luton hospital after a long illness at around midnight the previous evening. So he himself is having like a crisis electrocution that's going on here, like a crisis apparition, but it's the same kind of thing. Then, of course, you have a man by the name of Wilson, and this was reported in the book Apparition that Davis pulled out. It relates to an event that occurred in Liverpool, and this man saw a friend beckoning him into a field, right? And he's like, oh, that's kind of strange. And he knew this guy, right? And he's like, he knew that he was on a ship somewhere and he thought that he was in Jamaica, right? He thought he was in Jamaica, but to great surprise, he's standing in this field. So he wanders up to see his friend. As he gets closer and closer, he sees absolutely it's his friend. And at the very last second, his friend just sinks into the earth. Like, he just disappears into the earth. And the period of time is about 10 minutes that he's like walking closer and closer to him and the guy just disappears. Now, he goes and tells his other friends about this, who are all, you know, mutual friends with this guy. And, you know, clearly like, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. What a stupid thing to say, as if that really happened. But the following day, a vessel pulls into the port of Liverpool, and it has sad news. The captain says that his friend, who was the chief mate aboard this ship, had on the previous day fallen on the vessel, fractured his skull, and expired after 10 minutes.
Hmm.
So it's the same time frame. There's no way that he could have known this. Like, how does this, you know, particular thing take place? Now, let me describe this other story for you. This is interesting because this is like ties into the idea of there being guardians of fate or these entities that can control, you know, what happens with your fate. Because there's a woman by the name of, I think it was a Lady Harrison. Yes, it's Lady Harrison. And this was published in an edition of Country Law And it occurred.
Love that magazine.
Yeah, great, especially when it was published in March of 1625. But Lady Harrison was 3 months after giving birth, and she was struck down with the plague. Now, she died once, or seemingly died, and the doctors came and they confirmed that she was dead. But her husband didn't believe that she was dead. Like, he didn't believe it. And people were like, oh, this is grief. And, you know, of course you're not going to believe that she's dead, but, like, you know, come on, she's dead.
It's in denial.
Denial, exactly. But it just so happened that there was a passing doctor by the name of Wilson. This doctor came in and spoke to the husband, and the husband was insistent that she wasn't dead. And he says, well, I'll check. He's like, what I'll do is I'll make a small incision in her foot, you know, to cause pain. Now, he does. He makes a small incision in her foot and blood spews forth. It's only a small amount, but it's enough to indicate that she is indeed still alive. Immediately, she springs forth and starts asking, where are they? Where are the long-robed individuals? Like, where are they? And they're like, what are you talking about? And she says, oh, there were these two white-gowned figures that were standing in the room. They were right here. They told me that I had 15 more years because I wanted to stay here for my child. She's only given birth 3 months prior. The amazing thing about this story, and this is what was recorded, is that she lived for exactly 15 years from that event.
Yeah, wow.
And on the 15th anniversary, she died. Like, how is that occurring?
I was reading a story from Anke Everts just this morning, actually. She's got a new book called 9 Days of Eternity. I think she's an American woman who set herself on fire.
Ooh.
Accidentally. She was sitting in front of the, you know, the fireplace, and somehow she caught on fire. I don't know what she was wearing. But there was a point where she realized, like, I'm done, I'm gone. Mm. And she said it was peaceful, incredibly peaceful, because you always think burning alive's got to be the worst way to go.
Yeah, expect it to be extremely painful.
She said it was incredibly peaceful, and she left her body and watched the paramedics, watched, you know, the usual, watched the trip to the hospital, and, you know, looked at her body with just this cursory kind of intrigue, but wasn't attached. And then she said this 10-foot-tall being wearing a white robe appeared in the hospital room.
Again, with the white robes.
And she's taken on this journey. I might do it at a later date. But the funny detail about that is while she was in this hospital room, she's watching her body being looked after by the medical staff. They're in the same hospital room. There was another older woman in a bed next to hers. And so she's floating out of body, and she looks over at this older woman. And the older woman was asleep, but she had a smile on her face. And Anka remembers thinking, oh, I wonder why she's smiling. And as soon as she had that thought, she got sucked into this woman's body, and she was in this ballroom from, like, I don't know, the 1900s or something. And this woman was much younger, and she was in this beautiful ballroom dancing with this man, and she was so happy, and, you know, she's
like
holding
she's
him close.
A past life experience?
No, she entered into this woman's dream.
Oh.
Apparently that's something that can happen if you're out of body. She just wondered what was going on, and then she was in that woman's universe. So I might come back to that on a later show, but it was interesting. She mentions the white-robed angels.
They come up in so many reports. It's really strange, although, like, some of them can be a little bit cliche. So you have to wonder if there's, like, some type of, you know, cultural impression that's going on, or a belief which is influencing what they're seeing. I'm not saying that they're not seeing something and they're not experiencing something, but is it colored by your beliefs? And, you know, and that comes up in this story of Anna Atherton. So Anna Atherton seemingly passed away. Like, she was definitely dead according to the doctors, although in light of the stories that I've told you so far, they're not necessarily dead. Mm. But she seemingly was definitely dead. She claims that she found herself walking into, like, a clouded-like area, that she saw gates before her, you know, like Peter basically standing there offering to whether or not she can cross, you know, go through the gates. And she saw, I think it was like 3 or 4 people, like, approaching the gate, and a couple of them being let in and a couple of them being turned away, right? And, you know, she's like, oh, that's, like, really, really strange. Now, she comes back because they applied hot coals to the soles of her feet, and that caused her to come, you know, flying back. And when she comes back, she starts describing this experience. Now, this is November of 1670, so a very, very old report. But what's amazing about this report is that she was dead technically for, you know, an extended period of time. And in that period of time, the people that she had described, she starts telling the story, right? She has no way of knowing this. They actually had died. So it's like, and she'd seen them walk up to the pearly gates.
Yeah.
So it's like, how would she know that? How would that happen? So was, you know, did she was it that she was being influenced by her beliefs, or did she actually really see something?
Pearly gates, literally real, confirmed.
Pretty amazing. So the story that I want to leave you with, because we're coming to the end here, is the story of Ken Hastings. And this is just a truly astonishing story from 1988, so a relatively recent report. And essentially what happens is this guy is recovering from hip surgery. And he suffers an infection of some kind, and the infection gets out of control, and he dies. Like, technically, he dies from a medical standpoint.
Dies,
exactly. But while he's dead, and they're trying to get the smoke cart ready to go to shock him back, he says that he sees this, like, door, like, appear in the hospital room. Like, this light that kind of comes
cool.
in. It gets sucked into it, right?
Let me guess, he doesn't go in.
No, he does. He gets sucked into it. He's got no choice. He just gets sucked straight into it. He's sucked into this light. He says he comes to, holding a suitcase on a foggy hill, and he's trying to climb up this hill. And he looks up, right? He looks up and he says that he can see a train approaching at the top of this hill. So he comes up, and as he comes and through the fog, clears this train station. So he gets up onto the train station. He climbs onto the train. And he's like, there's all these people on the train. He doesn't know any of them. And he starts looking around, and he finds himself a seat. So he sits down and he's like, what the hell is this? Where am I? And a train conductor like spots him and comes straight to him. He's like, oh, do you have a ticket? And he's like, oh, no, sorry, I don't have a ticket. He says, oh, no, that's, and he, for whatever reason, he says to this ticket conductor, he's like, oh, no, my parents are waiting for me. Like, he doesn't know why he says this, but he's like, my parents are waiting for me. They'll pay for it, or they'll you know, vouch for me. He's like, oh, okay. And apparently, kindly, this train conductor says, sure, you can stay on board.
Are his parents still alive?
No, his parents are dead. But this train pulls into a station, and his parents are waiting for him at this station. So he goes up and he hugs his parents, and you know, they're like, nope, not your time. And he's like, what? And immediately they just turn around and disappear into the fog. And he says he's left with a space. Like, there's just this space before him, which he seemingly kind of tumbles through, and he finds himself back inside his bed, and he comes to. And for him, it was like this really weird, like, near-death experience where he got to meet his parents, because he came so close to that. But we've heard these stories with near-death experiences of, like, not even near-death experiences. There's all these reports of these oldies that have that, what's it called? Is it terminal lucidity? Where they're like, oh, I'm waiting for a train, or I've got a ship to catch.
Getting your suitcase ready for a journey on the deathbed.
And this guy had that exact experience. So just, you know, really amazing stuff. So that's Buried Alive, Horrors of the Undead by Rodney Davies. I'll link to it in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can check it, pardon me, so you can check it out for yourself. I might go into some of the more gruesome stuff in the Plus extension. We'll just see how we go. There is some really gruesome stuff in here.
It will go well with the freaky Nurgles I've got coming up in Plus.
It's pretty gruesome.
Okay.
But we'll see.
Okay. Yeah, coming up in our Plus extension, we've got Crawlers, a casebook from Nathaniel Brislin, talking about these strange, tall, thin, horrific looking humanoids. Is it creepypasta? Is there something to it? We're going to trace this back to the 1970s, look at the work of the legendary Lauren Coleman, dig up the old Dover Demon, and see if some of this connects. That's coming up on Mysterious Universe Plus. Head to the website, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus, if you want to get access. Sign up today and you get access to these big extensions we do on these shows every single week. And of course, Plus members get an entirely exclusive show that comes out every Tuesday. And you also get a higher quality MP3 version of the show if you're on Plus. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our 15 plus years of shows.
And full access to video content coming pretty soon.
That's right.
We're making those changes on the website.
Adding value all the time. Video, if everything goes well, the last hurdle we have now is website stuff. And my developer told me yesterday that he had to update the whole database to get it working.
Yeah, it's never easy. And always something.
The last thing he said to me is, you have to test everything before you go live. I'm like, how much time do you think I have to test everything? So
yeah, we'll just leave.
Let's just say we're in beta next week. We're going to be in beta, and we'll let you know on social media as soon as we're ready to go. But it's the best time to sign up for Plus. All that stuff's going to be available. The video is going to be exclusive for Plus members on the website. The full shows will be on the website exclusive to Plus members. And we'll throw the free shows up on YouTube and Rumble and anywhere else we can put them. That's a wrap for this show. Make sure you sign up, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Thanks for listening. If you're a free listener, we'll catch you next week. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. your Plus extension. Great to have you with us.